Our next case this morning is number 06-3193, the United States against Santiago. Mr. Carlson.
May it please the court, my name is Ken Carlson, and I was appointed to represent Alejandro Santiago both in the district court and before this court. Mr. Santiago pled guilty to possession of crack cocaine, but when it came time for his sentencing on that charge, he was tried and sentenced not just for possession of crack cocaine with intent to distribute, but also a completely unrelated murder, a murder that was not charged by any grand jury, for which he was not allowed to confront his accusers, was not found guilty by a jury of his peers in a public trial, but by a judge alone at the time of sentencing, without the benefit of the federal rules of evidence or the other constitutional rights that attach to a trial.
So are you just preserving this argument for the record? Because our case law has been pretty clear that the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply at sentencing. Can you find some way to distinguish this situation from our long line of cases that really rejects your argument, Mr. Carlson?
In large part, Your Honor, I am making this argument to preserve the issue. But I think this case is a little different than the average case that we get here, in which additional evidence is brought in at sentencing. This was a case where a murder was, in essence, tried in federal court, a murder that the state of Illinois sought not to prosecute. And I think the government came forward and said why the state of Illinois didn't prosecute. The two witnesses whose videotaped statements were admitted into evidence, those statements would not be admissible against Mr. Santiago in any trial, and they were not cooperating. So the state of Illinois couldn't prosecute him. So what do? They take that murder for which, as I said before, he's not indicted, he has none of the constitutional rights that would apply at a trial, and take that and in essence seek to increase his sentence by somewhere between 10 and 20 years. That is why I think this case is different. This is a case, and I don't remember the case that I think Judge Easterbrook decided, in which he said, it'd be different if it was a case where the tail is wagging the dog. I'm suggesting that that's what happened here. His original sentence in the district court, before the government filed their notice of enhancement, would have been a mandatory minimum of 10 years with a 140 to 175-month sentence. He was sentenced to 360 months, and the government had sought a sentence of 405 months. The sole reason for the filing of the enhancement, I was told, was he committed this terrible murder for which he's not being held accountable in a state court. It is standard practice in this district that the government files an indictment and they come to you and they say, we can file an 851 enhancement in this case, but we're not going to do it if your client's willing to plead guilty. Here, within a week of the filing of the indictment, an 851 notice was filed because of the participation in this murder. But then more than that, what happens is they then present the same evidence and use the same reason to justify a sentence which ended up to be 360 months. They were seeking 405 months based on the same evidence. And I think that's what makes this case different from the other cases that this court has decided.
Well, in addition to these videotapes, there's also the letter by your client. And that was something the court certainly took into consideration.
There is no question that Judge Gettleman took the letter into consideration. However, the statements themselves were the focus of the murder. The letter from Mr. Santiago would have been meaningless without the other evidence, without the statements of the two people who were charged in state court with this. His letter would have meant nothing. And I think it is important in that sense that those people were not cooperating. The government would not have had those people to present to Judge Gelman if they'd wanted to. Additionally, they could have charged. The United States of America could have charged Alejandro Santiago with this murder. This is not strictly a state court offense. They had the ability to do that. When they were busy bringing this case, bringing this sentencing to this building, they could have indicted him, and they could have brought a murder charge against him here. And if they had done that, what would have happened? He would have had all the constitutional rights, the benefit of the federal rules of evidence. He would have had all of those things. But they didn't want that to happen. So what do? They bring it in is under the guise of a sentencing enhancement. And that's what's really the problem here. It really is the case of the tail wagging the dog. And I think when we're talking about enhancing somebody's sentence that far, I believe that, you know, the constitutional rights to cross-examine witnesses and all constitutional rights should apply at that kind of a hearing, because this, in essence, was not just a sentencing hearing. If you look at the transcript of the proceedings, the vast majority of what was brought up and what was discussed and was presented by the government had to do with this murder. It had nothing to do with the other facts. That's what they really relied on. And I suggest that in a case like this, when this is what's going to happen, defendants deserve, the Constitution demands that they have the right to cross-examine the witness against them. They have a right to a trial by jury on it. That did not happen here. And I believe that, you can look at the reliability of these statements. I respectfully submit reliability in and of itself is not the be-all and end-all. There was not cross-examination. There was no way to test those statements. Judge Gelman merely looked at the videotapes of those. There was no cross-examination. There was no nothing. And I'm suggesting that under those situations in which the defendants in those cases themselves raised doubt argued that their statements were involuntary, Judge Gettleman himself made a finding that the statements were coached and rehearsed. They're just not reliable when you're seeking to enhance somebody's sentence by 10 to 20 years. They deserve more than what Mr. Santiago got here. And for those reasons, I would ask this court to vacate the sentence and remand this matter for resentencing. And I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We'll hear now from Mr. Patru.
May it please the court. The Reuter case, which is cited in our brief, Your Honors, clearly indicates that in a situation like such as this, where the government is actually alleging that a murder occurred and is using a murder to enhance a defendant's sentence, that it's appropriate to do so. In the Reuter case, the guidelines offense level was 105 months. The top of the offense level was 105 months. And the district court in that case actually imposed a sentence of 360 months after concluding that the defendant had been responsible for a murder. And in that case, the defendant also suggested on appeal, I believe it was in an Anders brief, that perhaps there should be some sort of heightened standard of proof at sentencing where you have a potential situation where the tail is wagging the dog. And in that case, most recently, this court concluded that there isn't some other heightened standard of proof at sentencing that applies. One of the reasons given in the opinion was because now that we have an advisory guidelines regime, it doesn't make much sense to add additional complications to our system of justice by imposing another standard of review at sentencing beyond that would ordinarily pertain. But let's look at this case in a practical fashion as well. Is this a case where the tail is wagging the dog? Not really. Because the sentence that the defendant was going to get as a result of the 851 enhancement was 20 years. So the dog in this case is twice as long as the tail. The sentence itself, or the sentencing enhancement, I should say, was not significantly greater than the sentence that the defendant would have received in any event.
That's the difference between 20 years and 30 years.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of time. I mean, if you're the one doing the time.
That is a lot of time. I agree with you, Judge. But the type of circumstance that's come to play where courts have talked about this tail wagging the dog phenomenon are the types of cases where, for example, somebody might be looking at a 3-year sentence, and then by virtue of an enhancement, there's a sentence of, say, like 20 years. And let me give you an example in this case particularly. There was initially an issue about whether or not the defendant had in his possession crack cocaine. Now, that factual dispute, which the defendant stipulated to prior to sentencing, was a type of situation where there was a much greater differential at play based on the finding that crack was involved. Based on a preponderance finding that crack was involved, the mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years would come into play. If there had been a finding that it was merely cocaine, then there would have been a much lower sentence involved. That would have been a situation where you'd be talking about a quintessential tail wagging the dog scenario. That was not the case here. With respect to the government's decision to file an 851 enhancement, that's the government's prerogative. There's been no suggestion that the government acted in a racial, out of racial animus or any invidious classification.
Do you agree with why the Collin murder wasn't charged in the state court? Mr. Carlson suggests it's because there were problems with admissibility of the videotape statements at the state court level.
Well, at the state court level, I would suspect that the videotape statements of those participants in the crime would not have been admissible. But of course, it's the state's prerogative whether or not to charge that crime against this defendant. If you were to exclude the statements of the co-conspirators, as I'll call them, and look at the other evidence in this case, one could construct a case against this defendant. What we have is a situation where the defendant, if you look at the news media at the time this offense occurred, was saturated with coverage relating to Jesus Colon. And some of our exhibits that were admitted at the sentencing hearing that the court properly could take notice of without respect to any issue relating to evidentiary rules demonstrated that Jesus Colon had been named as a victim in a kidnapping, and that also Victor Lopez and Jose Perez had also been identified as individuals that had been taken into custody in relation to that murder, or that kidnapping, I should say. And so right around that time, the defendant is sending his brother a letter when he's in custody, and he's sending that letter using his attorney's name. He's disguising it as legal mail. And what does the defendant say in that letter? He tells his brother that he's going to have to pay with his life for what's happened. And he references, I think, J-Dog and B-Man, or terms like that, to refer to Victor Lopez and Jose Perez. And he talks about how they've been talking to the police, and after they've talked to the police, that he's finished. He talks to his brother about how he hopes his daughter doesn't think that he's a monster for what he's done. He talks about perhaps maybe saving his brother and some other members of the conspiracy. And then there were also the phone calls between Adalberto Santiago and Francis Bell on the day of the kidnapping. There were approximately 16 calls between 9 o'clock and 9:30, which is the time period involved with respect to the kidnapping at the Logan Square subway station. So if the police had wished, or had the state prosecutors wished, to bring this case in state court, I would submit that they had the evidence to do it. It's their prerogative what they choose to do and what they don't choose to do. The federal government's obligation in a situation like this is to do what it thinks is right, and we were well within our bounds in actually bringing this information to the district court's attention. The district court found that the confession, as represented in the letter, was reliable. The district court also had an opportunity to review the videotape and was able to assess the demeanor of the individuals that gave those statements on videotape and concluded that they were reliable as well. And so there's no reason to disturb that decision.
Let me ask you this. Do you think there should be any limits on the government's ability to introduce unrelated conduct at the sentencing phase, especially when the conduct is also uncharged, and like here where it appears that the murder is totally unrelated from the charged conduct?
Judge, there should be very few limits in that regard, because 3553A requires the court to consider the history and the characteristics of the defendant. And one of the characteristics of this defendant is what he's done. What type of person is he? This is an individual that not only committed this murder by holding somebody down, suffocating them to death, and then chopping their body up into pieces with a chainsaw afterwards, but in addition to that, there was an older murder as well, which granted by way of the sentencing guidelines would not normally be counted, but certainly it is a characteristic of the defendant that should be considered in deciding what type of sentence is involved. Now, could there be a situation where there is some type of conduct which should not be considered? Yes, but in terms of prior criminal conduct, I'd find it difficult to understand why a sentencing court under 3553A should be precluded from considering that type of conduct. If there are no further questions, I tend to the balance of my time to the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Batru. Mr. Carlson has how much time? 2.5 minutes, sir.
Thank you. One of the things Mr. Batru just says is in accordance with what I'm trying to say here. If we're not going to place limits on the kind of evidence that can be brought to a sentencing judge's attention at sentencing, then the full constitutional rights apply. If we're going to say we can take uncharged conduct and sentence people for that conduct when they haven't been tried, convicted, charged, given all the constitutional rights they have, then there's a problem with that. And that's exactly my point here. If they're going to do that, then all constitutional rights should apply, because that is the tail wagging the dog. That's sentencing people for not the offense they committed, but for unrelated conduct. And I suggest to you that when that is the case, the Constitution must be applied and it must be enforced. The government taking their argument to the logical limit would say, in almost any case in which a defendant makes an inculpatory statement, right of confrontation is meaningless. That is not true. And that result would be absurd, and the Constitution wouldn't allow that to happen. And so I think the right of confrontation is critical here. And in talking about, lastly, about 3553, one of the major goals behind 3553 is to promote respect for the law. I suggest to this court that enhancing somebody's sentence by 10 to 20 years for unrelated, uncharged conduct for which you are not allowed to have any constitutional rights, you can't cross-examine a witness as the federal rules of evidence apply, that does not promote respect for the law. And 3553 says that is one of the major goals, is to promote respect for the law. I would ask this court to, again, vacate the sentence and remand it for resentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Carlson, you served by appointment of this court, and we would like to thank you for your fine efforts on behalf of your client. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.